Welcome to episode 106 of the Nerds Assemble podcast.
This week we'll be looking at Final Fantasy 15, Misfits, Jason Bourne, and our feature this week, are we, as geeks and nerds, our own worst enemies?
Hi, I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, a.k.a. Cookie.
And I'm Paul, a.k.a. Retride.
As ever, you can find the show notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We can also comment, and you can also find links to our social accounts. Plus, you can get in touch and ask us questions or comment on the show by email at contact@nerdassemble.co.uk. Or you could tweet us at nerdspodcast. But first, Take It Gabe show's happening, because, you know, that's a thing. And they show off video games there, and it's in Tokyo. And finally, out of 8 years of murky development haze, something has emerged, which is the main trailer, new trailer for Final Fantasy 15. I mean, there was a hint of something last year, but or was it earlier this year? Maybe earlier this year, but this is the full, oh my gosh, what's going on kind of thing. And well, it looks like there's a road trip.
It looks like a very fancy version of Cadillacs and Dinosaurs.
I'd like that. That would be good.
With big swords that randomly somehow can disappear and then reappear. And what is with the hair?
It's a boy band.
It seems like that.
Maybe
it's two or three. Well, they did Final Fantasy X-2, didn't they?
Yeah, and it was the girls.
Yeah, this is the boys' turn now.
Okay.
My issue is that because it's been so long in development, and from my experience, when things are in development for so long, they actually become bad.
Duke Nukem Forever. Aliens Clonal Marines.
So, not all the time.
I don't recognise those words.
Daikatana.
Oh, the weirdest thing was, having watched the trailer after watching Paul, and I played it a bit as well, sort of Hyrule Warrior over the weekend, and watching the trailer, I was like, wait a moment, this is like the battle system from that Dynasty Warriors thing that Hyrule Warrior was based on. What the hell's going
just
on?
Just with slightly less characters.
Yeah.
And more hair gel.
Lots more hair gel. Gosh, I mean...
Actually, come to think of it, Hyrule Warriors has a lot of female characters. This has solely male characters.
Except for that one random female character who appeared in a tiny segment of the trailer. Who's
a date.
Pardon?
Didn't he call her a date or something on the trailer? Where's your date?
Yeah, it's like, what? This is great. I'm currently not reassured about issues of female representation in this trailer.
Well, she was there to look pretty, really, wasn't she? And to be honest, so were they.
Yeah. Yeah. At least they got a car out of it.
Mm. I mean, if there's one thing that I can say about the Final Fantasy series is that female characters haven't necessarily been badly portrayed.
Been in a way playable female characters in each iteration.
Yeah.
To some extent.
I mean, Lightning was quite kick-ass.
Yeah.
You know, even though, you know, a lot of people don't like her, she's basically somebody that could have been a guy, but wasn't. It wasn't like, oh, look at my breasts and, you know.
Except for what happened in Lightning Returns, where they just seem to take the character of Lightning, and because of the whole costume thing kind of ruined her a bit. Mm.
What I'm trying to say is that
it's a girl with costumes and clothes, so therefore blah blah.
What I'm trying to say is that in the original Final Fantasy 13, at least Lightning was a Ripley type character, a character that didn't seem specifically like it had to be female.
Yeah, which was good. I think what also concerns me, having seen this trailer, is the new battle system just looks like What's the fecking point at this point? It should be, you just walk up to an enemy, press X, and then just leave them to it.
I mean, when I watched the trailer, I'm not sure whether it was just me not noticing, but there wasn't any, well, there didn't seem to be any kind of
button
attack
prompts.
Or, yeah, button yeah. prompts. It was basically almost like a, you know, clean screen. And is that, you're kind of pretty much in expert mode where you don't need the buttons on screen all the time, or, well.
It just looked kind of pointless that you were fighting anything at all. Because the enemies they waltz up to, like at the beginning, like those great big lumbering creatures, it was like they were just happily grazing there. Mm. They weren't something that went yeah. after you.
It was more like a rodeo trip, wasn't it? Oh, look, there's some boar. Get it. Kill it. It's all fun. It's hunting. We're men. Ah.
I mean, bear in mind that obviously, you know, there's obviously been in development various iterations of this game. So by, you know, coming out with that trailer as pretty much the first kind of, this is going to be the actual game kind of trailer.
Well, I mean, like I said, there was that one that's been, other one that was released in the past 12 months where they had the guy that was maybe one of the main guys running around some kind of city whilst being shot at, and you saw a bit of, but then that looked a bit different to what we saw in terms of the combat, limited combat that was in this trailer, yeah, in between those driving shots.
There you go. I would imagine the combat would have been one of the first things to actually get down.
My take is it's probably just presented like that so they can make it all, look all cinematic so that, you know, it doesn't have any on-screen prompts. I would say it would do, I'd hope it would do, in the actual game.
Yeah.
And secondly, I'm very disappointed at how practical all the fashions seem to look.
Well, that's because they haven't got any female characters there either, though. So
yeah, but they don't have someone, you know, with a shirt collar that's so high you can basically only see his nose upwards. Like in Final Fantasy X.
I have to say, with most of the, you know, main Final Fantasy games, you have had characters which do look very different from each other.
Yeah.
You know, even like Final Fantasy VIII, you know, that obviously the different costumes and whatnot, but even when they're in the Seed uniforms, you could tell Squall was Squall because of his haircut. You could tell that Zell was Zell because of his haircut. You could tell that Irvine was Irvine because of his hat
Here,
and long hair.
All they really did was just kind of change the hair colours a bit, but the overall styles were the same.
Yeah, it's just, oh, right, one of the things I've really enjoyed, asterisk, bye, about previous Final Fantasy games is how unlikable a lot of the male characters are, because they just seem to be, you know, standoffish twats. And I'm thinking, yay, now there's four of them in a car!
And they get to drive around!
Yeah.
And have adventures!
Well, you're all apathetic and yeah, we're so cool, we're in a car. Let's beat up some creatures that were just grazing in the field. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there should have been something better than just, you know, footage of beating up random creatures.
I think what's perhaps concerning is that during the past week, the director of Final Fantasy XV, who'd been with it since the start, has stepped down, which is Tetsuya Nomura. And he's being superseded by his co-director, which was it Hajime Tabata? I want to pronounce it Tabata, but yeah.
You have bad enough time
pronouncing English surnames,
exactly.
Like pronouncing Japanese surnames.
Exactly.
I know. It's just
seems
the games.
Them to go.
It's what now? 12 years since Final Fantasy X was released, and the game looks so far removed from the systems that were introduced in that, with this whole, oh, let's have this free-form fighting in the environment. You don't get put into a set battle screen or anything. And while I could just about handle that in Final Fantasy XIII, they've gone such a step further now in the appearance of how battles.
Final Fantasy XIII went back to the dinghy. It was Final Fantasy XII. That in-field battle.
But I'm saying that I like Final Fantasy XIII with the way it kind of did it, and now we're back out in the field, and it's just, it doesn't look like a Final Fantasy game, it just looks like pretty people running around who apparently have no real distinguishing characteristics, other than that one of them might have something to do with the royal family.
Yeah.
Oh, and they own a nice car.
I mean, I'm assuming some of the music done on it is going to be done by One Direction as well, just to really fit the mood.
Well, unfortunately, it's certainly long past the days of, what was it, the Yumatsu... I can't remember his name, but the guy that did most of the earlier soundtracks for Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
I think basically what I'm saying is that I want somebody to make Lost Odyssey 2, but not Lost Odyssey 2. I think that's what I'm saying.
I would definitely get behind that.
Yeah.
I liked Lost Odyssey 2. And that was the main character who wasn't just an arse.
Yep.
So there we go. You've heard it, you know, right? Go and make Lost Odyssey 2. Scrap this Final Fantasy 15.
I got to read out this one tweet that got highlighted by Kotaku, which was by Nick C or Itoju. I'll probably link to it on the post. And he said, "Final Fantasy, once about grand adventure, now about handsome dudes who dress way better than me going on road trips in expensive cars."
What's not to like?
I obviously this is just, you know, the first trailer and we have been ripping the piss out of it. Presumably there's other content other than a road trip in the final game.
Although I'm saying all this, and I have tried a few times, you know, I've mentioned trying to play Final Fantasy X-2 and just completely being unable to get past about the first 10-15 minutes of it because I just found the entire thing horrifying. I'm wondering if this is going to be the same.
There was a stupid level of fan service in there, and not even good style fan service. I'll probably get onto that later with Hyrule Warriors.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Oh.
I'm gonna move us on to our Misfit story, which is that the movie that they had been hoping to do, based on the TV series Misfits, has pretty much sunk dead in the water. Not because there isn't a script. Howard Overman has written a script. It's the fact that existing cast members or former cast members from the series, everyone's moved on too much, and there's just can't get anyone down long enough to film something. Everyone's schedules are just so jam-packed.
It's a shame because... Well, personally, I didn't even realise that there was planning on being a movie.
Yeah.
But second of all, I think it was a good series, and it's a shame that, you know, they couldn't do more with it.
It could have had a bit more considering where it ended. It needed a tiny bit more. I'm not saying it needed tons more, it just needed a tiny, tiny bit more. It would have been nice if they'd done like a Christmas special after.
Yeah, yeah.
What had happened. But yeah.
There's definitely more that could be done with that universe.
I think it's just the fact that it was one of the most originally done hero, anti-hero concepts that had been done in the past 10 years on television.
Well, that's the thing. I think it was symptomatic of the time. Well, I'll say symptomatic of the time. We're still technically in the symptomatic of the time. But when... there were superheroes that weren't actually superheroic. They were basically just people with powers.
Yeah.
You know, a bit like what happened with Heroes. That was like, oh, you know, there's going to be people with powers flying about. And it's like, yeah, but how many of them were actually doing good things and being heroic? not that many, actually.
But just, it would have been nice to have done a film that was kind of like where they do finally do something that's globally heroic, maybe, with still all the down-to-earth elements that persisted in the TV series. Certainly as a counter to the deluge of regular comic book movies we're going to be suffering from for the next, you know, how many years.
I have to say, I mean, because obviously there's certain kind of British series like this and like No Heroics where, you know, the British TVs tried to tackle, you know, certain aspects of the superhero genre and whatnot, and they are quite good. They do come out quite well, but they don't seem to go anywhere.
No Heroics was brutally short-lived.
Yes, that was. That was like a single series, 6 episodes, brilliantly written.
Extremely funny.
And, no, quite very imaginative as well.
I think part of the problem is that it was bung on ITV2 at odd times of day. Oh, there you go. Doesn't help anything.
Mm.
It's like somebody at ITV must have been like, oh, suppose we could give this production company this money. It'll be all right. It'll be all right. We can put it on a reasonable place and time. Oh, fudge. Somebody found out that I gave this reasonable idea money and they're not reasonable. Better bung it somewhere else. Just
quick hide.
Hide it under the carpet. Just kind of like a big pile of dust. And hope nobody notices. Which is kind of like what they did with the Clerks cartoon when they had access to it to screen it.
The thing is that there's no such thing to do. Well, there's getting words mixed up. But you don't need to do that anymore because of online content. The fact that, you know, you can stick a program on there on, say, for example, Netflix or, you know, your own service like it. Say, for example, on the ITV player in this instance, they could stick it on there, see how many people, you know, kind of go for it, and if the numbers are okay, just do another series, even if they stick it just online.
I don't think that could have happened for No Heroics though at the time it was out, because the online video hadn't quite established itself at the point. Like, it was around, but
true,
it wasn't
true.
The platform that lots of people knew about. Like, nobody over here really knew about Netflix when, like, No Heroics is around, kind of thing. So,
on the plus side, give it about 2 years and they'll be eligible for a reboot.
is that a bright side?
I think that's a damning indictment of the rate at which things are being reproduced.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking that's not a good thing.
No.
But going back to Misfits for a moment, the Americans were interested in trying to do it for themselves at one point as a TV series, and I don't think they actually did. They didn't actually manage to make anything, did they?
We would never find out because, well, you know, they've tried to do a lot of
online.
They've tried to do a lot of stuff, you know, but redo a lot of British series.
Fair few things leaked. It's like, I remember seeing some of the American version of Spaced.
Oh,
which
God.
Sounds wrong.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, because Misfits was like Skins crossed with Heroes for all intents and purposes. And that's like, yeah, the Heroes element might translate well to taking Misfits over to the US, but considering what happened when MTV tried remaking Skins and then they had to abandon it, that was never going to go well.
I think with Misfits though, I think its location was one of the iconic things about it. You know, it was, you know, built up urban area in you know, city like London, and I'm not entirely sure whether they could really quite do the same kind of gritty thing in, well, presumably they could just set in LA or something like that.
Then that didn't. That would have made sense. And then they would have ended up in either like New York or Chicago, or maybe they could have done it in somewhere like Boston, but then it'd be like, not quite the same kind of
vibe. Yeah.
But okay, so there's no Misfits film currently being made. It has been shelved for the time being, according to an interview with star Antonia Thomas, who played Alicia in the first three series. She'd been talking with Radio Times about that. So I'm gonna.
Apparently, it seemed like there were scripts produced.
Scripts produced. Everyone was up for it, but nobody had the schedule available to kind of make producers and whatnot go, okay, let's try it.
Which, to be fair, I kind of understand because Misfits was quite a hit, and we have seen most of the people in like other things. I mean, the guy that played Nathan obviously was went to Utopia. The guy that could turn himself like invisible, he's in a drama, something about the army, Afghanistan type thing.
And he's also in Game of Thrones.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. The guy that played, what's his name? The Irish guy in...
Just to narrow it down, he plays a bit of a weirdo.
Okay. But they've all kind of gone off to do other things. Even the one that had the heart transplant that could teleport, she went off to do Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah,
true.
So, yeah, I can completely understand that. It's been a good launching platform for them, if nothing else.
Because we're very good at having, you know, kind of little breakout hits because they're on a, you know, a quite a tight budget.
Mm.
But then there's so little other work.
Yeah.
People bugger off to the US.
Well, yeah, which is kind of understandable.
The only way everyone who's an actor over here could get enough work is if somehow Downton Abbey decided to become the English upper hierarchies of the early 20th century. All of them.
I think we should be thankful that I haven't tried to redo that.
I quite like the idea, but just based on you know, how you said it, quite like the idea of Downtown Abbey now.
But so, oh no, that was something. I think, was it last night's episode? I was, because obviously I'm not watching Downton Abbey. It's not happening. It's not happening. But they had a whole sponsorship or sort of advertising deal with Amazon's Kindle, and there was just this whole ad setup going on where they had the Downton Abbey characters dressed as themselves, but obviously kind of on a break and reading from their Kindles and talking about it in the ads and breaking,
so
like, and like breaking the fourth wall. And I think one of the complaints I saw was that people found it really annoying because it was making it hard for them to suspend their disbelief when it came back to the actual
show. I'm not surprised, because I mean, it sounded like the way that they did the adverts was that it wasn't very clear that they were adverts, and it was just like random people with Kindles in Downton Abbey.
The thing I heard about that was you may have heard that, you know, some people have been trying to put a little bit of pressure on Amazon for their employment record and paying a fair wage.
Yeah.
You know, and all the restrictions that they put on their works, like, you know, they're monitored every step of the way and, you know, all that, you know, kind of thing. Well, in the spirit of what people have done with other Amazon reviews, they've been reviewing Downton Abbey, except talking about the tax policies and, you know, the campaign for a fair wage for their warehouse workers and stuff like that. And so far as I've heard, anyway, it's like, you know, okay, at least Amazon haven't removed in any of that. But I just really like the fact it happened.
To be honest, I'm surprised that with, you know, because there are quite a few, like, well, some American productions, like Game of Thrones, that are actually filmed, you know, kind of elsewhere outside of the US. I'm surprised that they haven't actually started to develop smaller studios in other countries.
Well, it makes sense, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
Would do, yeah.
Or they could just hire our ones and give us more money.
Yeah, but they like control.
You say that, but I mean, Star Wars Episode 7's being filmed at, was it Pinewood at the moment?
Yeah, but presumably that's just as, you know, they're just using the studio space rather than...
Yeah, but they're still having to pay huge amounts of rent for that.
Yeah.
Do you think that'll be a big film?
I can't tell rightly just this moment. I'm really not sure.
Everybody's going to just have memories of Jar Jar Binks and boycott the place.
Oh, Jesus.
I could almost imagine people queuing up to watch it at stupid o'clock, dressed in various types of strange outfit. Maybe sat in fold-up chairs.
I'm going to be camping out there 4 nights before just to get in the premiere. Yeah, baby.
I want to move us on to our next final news story for the week. Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass are returning to the Jason Bourne franchise.
Yay!
I've still not seen any of them.
You fool! You fool! You need to watch at least the first two.
I really enjoyed the Bourne trilogy.
I really like the series, and I even liked the
Jeremy Renner one.
Yeah. Bourne Legacy.
To be honest,
I quite liked it as well.
It was not good, but it just didn't have the same oomph as the other Bourne films. Same sort of tension and suspense, I thought. That might just be me.
I thought it had a slightly more sci-fi element to it, considering you know, one of the main plot points. I don't want to spoil it for people because...
there are the other films I still haven't seen. Like there's, Born Free.
Born to be Wild.
Born to be Wild and Born Every Minute. I'll stay quiet now.
Yeah. But Variety's reported that sources have told them that Universal Pictures is gearing up to bring the pair back on board. There's meant to be another Jeremy Renner Bourne film that's meant to be kind of happening, which was for something like 2016. They don't know quite where this would slot in to the schedule. One assumes, I would have thought afterwards, obviously.
I would actually quite like them to meet up.
That would be good.
What, for a drink? And you'd be in the pub,
In a chin rag. And a chin rag, and a pub brawl. And then they realise who they are and they just kick the shit out of each other.
I would like to point out, for what might be... I think I've mentioned this less than 10 times on the podcast over the past couple of years, but I far prefer the Bourne films to the recent James Bond films by quite a bit. Quite a huge bit.
I am a huge Bond fan. I've got every single movie on DVD. And
I don't like the Daniel Craig films.
The Daniel Craig films were a lot darker than the other ones, than the previous iterations, I think. They didn't have the sort of same humour as Pierce Brosnan that had it to it, but I actually quite liked some of the segments in the Bond film. Casino Royale, was okay. The second one, what was it? The Skyfall, the third one, I really enjoyed, I have to say.
Second one's Quantum of Solace.
There you go, Quantum Solace. Yeah, that wasn't too bad either. But they didn't seem to hit the mark. But then Skyfall, I could watch that all day, to be honest.
I think...
amazing set piece.
Do I need to remind people that I fell asleep during both Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace?
To be honest, I think I may have done the same. It's either that or I was doing something else. And...
I will say that I really enjoyed Casino Royale, but the next two were not that great in comparison.
It was obvious with Casino Royale in the fact that that came in the wake of the Bourne films, that they were like, oh god, somebody's done a different kind of spy film that wasn't Mission Impossible, and we need to suddenly do something a bit different, so let's get him actually doing moves that look like he's actually hitting people in the face. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of adding that gritty realism to the action scenes.
I really liked about it was, Bond has always been a, Lothario. But in Casino Royale, they had him, trying to seduce a woman for information? And then as soon as he didn't need her, he was out.
Yeah.
He didn't finish. It was just a job. So, you didn't have the, sexy lady. Ooh, Bond. Ooh, yes. It's like, yeah, I'll do this, but it's a job. I just need the information. I am out.
Technically more realistic, but somehow it kind of lacks the, lightness of, the previous lot.
Yeah, but I didn't particularly like the lightness of the previous lot, so...
Mm. And I quite like the quips and, the gadgets.
I don't mind them, just to a certain degree. It's when it becomes about the quips and the gadgets that I just got incredibly bored.
I
can just imagine James Bond now suddenly being like, okay, so what's the next mission? We don't have a mission, but here's some toys to play around with.
I demand that in the
sexy lady to bring them in for you.
I demand that in the next James Bond film, he has to go for it turns out that there is a sort of STD testing schedule for all 00 agents, and he's tested it, and they find out that he has got not just gonorrhea, he's got the super gonorrhea that's going around that there's no cure for at the moment, but there is actually in fact a villain who has actually got a cure for it, but he's holding out and giving it to the world because, oh my god, patents.
and that's you are the film. That's the film. Him trying to get hold of the patents and the information for making this cure for super gonorrhea.
So you're basically wanting a James Bond version of the episode of Misfits.
Yes.
You know the one I mean, don't you? It's gone black.
That's
reminding me of something. What is it? Oh, it's Misfits.
There was also the other episode where the genitalia swapped as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that will be a good one for James Bond.
I think having to secure the cure for super gonorrhea makes far more sense.
Have you seen who wants to play the next Bond, though?
No, I haven't.
Denzel Washington.
What, wants to play the next Bond?
Mm-hmm.
No, Idris Elba or nothing.
You are?
Wait, is that just your general credo?
In this particular, you know, let's give... If we're going to suddenly start, you know, casting in differently like this, I think we should give it to a Brit.
Oh, definitely he has to be a Brit.
Yeah. I can go with that. But
I'd quite like the guy who plays Luther. That'd be cool.
That is.
Yeah, that is Idris Elba.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's one of the few actors' names that isn't somebody I've seen a bazillion times I can remember. That's because I really liked his character in the Thor films.
You know what I want for the next Bond film?
Super gonorrhea.
No. Not super gonorrhea. Thank you very much. I don't want that. What I want is a flashback.
I just want to sample that and play it back out of context.
What I want is a flashback from Pierce Brosnan's era, and then him being shot and then regenerating as Daniel Craig.
No.
Just, you know, James Bond happens to be, you know, the second to last time.
Meanwhile, the next Bond film, I'm just happy for him to just punch more people and improvise, like, just sort of, like, cool stuff out of stuff and be a one-man army without tons of gadgets. But Bond, I have higher standards it needs to be held up to, I'm afraid.
I think he hasn't really had that many gadgets in the last couple of films, as he compared to other films like, if you look at other films like Octopus.
Oh, he hasn't needed all the gadgets because he's had all that product placement.
I thought he was going to say all that super gonorrhea then.
He may also have super gonorrhea. We don't know. We haven't seen the STD testing scene back at MI6 HQ.
No,
that's what MI6 HQ is. Just looking after all their agents.
I'm gonna move us on to what people have been up to.
Can I just ask before we do that? Though,
yeah.
If this new James Bond did come out with super gonorrhea,
yeah,
would it take a title from a previous one, which was it Thunderball? Or Thunderballs. Or Fireballs.
No.
Okay.
No. Retrobe, what have you been up to?
I have been playing more TXK, a bit more Outlast, which is still living up to a Shit Me Up. And more Goddess, which I've been enjoying, but it's also been infuriating me. And I thought that's why, you know, I'll talk about Goddess more. As I said last week, it's God Simulator by Peter Molyneux's new, 22 Cannons developer. He's primarily responsible for things like Populous and, you know, Powermonger in the past. So, you know, that's precisely why I picked this up. And I've been playing a bit more. I'm getting further into the game, and it's introducing more of a sort of a versus mechanic against a, you know, competitor tribe in the same world. And that's where I'm starting to really get, you know, irked by the faults more than anything. I mean, bearing in mind it's still an open, you know, an early access game. So, okay, fine, there are going to be issues. And also, this is my first game of it. So it's not like I've been, you know, starting again and again and, you know, finding the same problems. I will say that, you know, with any game like this, the first time you play it through, you're going to screw up the first time around because you haven't encountered the mechanics before. So it could well be that, but I am coming up against a repeated wall of my followers having fucking awful pathfinding. I mean, really bloody awful. And when you have to spend belief points, mana, whatever you want to call it, which you harvest from your population in order to reform the landscape layers so you can you know, form a path for your followers to get through. When you're having to do that and you've given them a path to use, but they are resolutely not using that path, and they're repeatedly trying to climb up a different bit, which is just to the side of it, and it's just so bloody frustrating.
I mean, I hope they fix that.
Yeah, it sounds like an AI, script fault type thing.
Yeah, I am really hoping they fix it. But according to Steam, I have played it for 10 hours. So it must be doing something right.
You're just not sure quite what at the moment.
Well, I like the mechanisms of you can get people building the little huts, and you give them flat areas, you know, to build them, and then you can harvest their belief points and form them into small towns, and then they can produce farmers who will till fields, and you use that as a resource to build more, you know, and bigger houses. So I like those kinds of things, and I really do like the art style, and you would not believe the amount of hours I put into the original Populous and Populous 2 back in the Amiga. So and Powermonger. So I'm hopeful for it, but yeah, when it comes to pathfinding, if you're going to have mechanisms where they can't climb two layers at once, so you have to separate them out, at least have it so that they will properly find the paths. It's just really frustrating.
Okay. Cookie, what have you been up to?
I have finally managed to get GTA 5 to work.
Woo! Wow.
I'm really enjoying it, especially after last week, because it means I've just been zooming around the map and not doing very much apart from blowing people up and mowing them down and getting wanted points.
Have you had a game of tennis yet?
No.
To be fair, it sounds like even if you absolutely hated the game, you'd still play it because it took you so long to get it to work.
Yeah, I mean, it was just it was down to my PS3 at the time. It just kept on crashing halfway through the opening sort of level scene, which is really infuriating when it tells you to do something and you go and do it and nothing happens.
Yeah,
so you end up shooting everybody in the room just to see if it happens, if it resets, and it's doesn't reset. So you sat there thinking, okay, I can't go any further, can't do anything else. Oh, well, reset it. But now I've been able to get it all sorted. And I don't think I'd actually say I would still play it if I didn't enjoy it. I do enjoy it. I mean, it's got a lot more. The problem I had with GTA 4 was it was a lot more, although the story was a lot more deep than that. I've always liked the GTA series for being able to just chill out for half an hour and just drive around listening to my 80s rock music and just mow around and find little things to do and have a bit of fun with it. And that seems to be a lot more evident in GTA 5, to be fair. I have actually started doing the GTA Online as well, which I've been very surprised by. I have to say the community's actually quite all right in there. I've only had one person who's actually deliberately come up to me and killed me, which I was expecting a lot more of, to be fair.
It's a good job you don't hold the same standards in real life.
Absolutely, yeah.
I was thinking, okay, but my experience with GTA Online has been different, where I just, you know, logged on the 360, and I was looking through my phone, and someone ran me over, and then backed up over me, and ran me over again, and then backed up over me, got out and shot me. Welcome to Los Santos.
On my first entry there, I went on to some of the sort of jobs like the team death matches and stuff. And then I got invited to some flat. Somebody invited me to their flat, so I was wandering around there, just chatting away, so that was quite cool. And then I went on to another team death match, killed somebody, and when we got out, they seemed to hold a grudge and they killed me. I was like, okay. So I you can actually challenge them to a one-on-one death match if they keep on killing you. So I did, and he logged off. Don't know why.
Okay.
It's actually been quite... It's a really nice flowing game, and the graphics are just out of this world. It looks amazing. And I have to admit, it's just fun just to be able to just drive around somewhere and that. I mean, I've also been playing Watch Dogs, which is very similar to the sandbox mode, but... I have to say, it's not as enjoyable because the driving, oh my God, the driving mechanic is so fucking shit.
Oh dear.
It infuriates me every time I play it. I've been stuck on one mission where I stupidly went to this side mission, and all you've got to do is get a car back to stolen car back to a point on the map. So they can just take it off and sell it or whatever. And I have spent about 2 hours trying to do this. And every time I get to 200 yards away from the actual thing, after wrecking the car, there's steam coming out of the tyres. All the fenders about bounce back in because the police just don't give a shit. They really don't in the game. I mean, I'm stopping to let civilians pass. And they're just mowing them down and trying to corner me. And I'm like, whoa, hang on. They're the police. Hang on. Isn't this supposed to be the other way around? Hang on. But I've got to like 200 yards away. And it's in a garage. So I open up the door. And then all of a sudden, the police are there again. And suddenly you've got to lose the police again. I'm thinking, really? And it is quite difficult to actually control the car. It does tend to sway a bit and drift into things, and you don't ever seem to have as much control in the car as you do on GTA 5. Yeah. The handbrake turns and that sort of thing, it just slides all the way over there. I mean, I thought I had the perfect getaway this afternoon. I was really going for it. I had found the railway tracks. I was going down the railway track. I thought, I'll lose them. It's not a problem. And I wondered why they weren't following me. That's because, for some reason, the railway track ends on a massive cliff and you just go straight into the sea.
What?
And I'm like, what? What the fuck is going on here, man? What?
I mean, yeah.
I've got a map.
In a roundabout way, that kind of reminds me, with you saying about, handling and some of the AI and stuff. It's just reminded me with Goddess. You have these bonus missions that you can do. Mm. And, where you send off in like 30 followers on a ship and they'll go to, different little islands, and they're basically like little puzzles where you have to get your followers from the start to a temple within a time limit. And there's either like a giant that will kill your followers, or there's swamps, or there's fire, all these kinds of things where you have to edit the landscape to get your followers to the other side. But the problem I've had is, again, with the pathfinding, where I will build them a path to get in as close to a straight line as I possibly can to their destination, and then they'll just start climbing the side of a hill, which isn't even in the right direction. And you just go, what the hell are you doing? I played the game right. What the hell are you doing? And of course, you fail the time limit.
Yeah.
And so it's like with any game where you fail because the game is failing.
Mm.
And that just sounds like that kind of situation where it just drives me mad.
That reminds me of Lemmings slightly. Just the fact that Lemmings. It's just the fact that you don't actually control the lemmings directly type thing.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to kind of nudge them, and sometimes they just do things wrong.
At least they work, you know, in only, you know, a flat plane.
Mm.
They're only in two dimensions, and they're far more...
Well, I think there was a 3D difficult. Lemmings game, but I'm not entirely sure how that worked.
We don't speak of that.
Oh, dear. So it's not bad enough for you to deny its existence, but it's bad enough so that we can't talk about it.
It's like the, you know, I have no son.
I think I want to ask Paul what he's been up to now.
Okay, well, I picked up a copy of Hyrule Warriors. I've been liking the look of it for a while. I have heard a load of people turn around and saying, "Oh, well, it looks exactly like Dynasty Warriors just reskinned."
Yes.
And I've never played Warriors, Dynasty Warriors, but I did actually really enjoy Hyrule Warriors. So, yeah, it's nowhere near as button bashy as people kind of make out. I mean, yes, there is a simple combo system: press X X X X X, or X X X Y Y, X X X Y Y Y Y type thing. But yeah, on the whole, I think the strategy on the battlefield is actually quite refreshing in a way. It's kind of like a cross between an action game and an RTS.
Mm.
So.
Oh, and the co-op works.
Yes, the co-op does work. Admittedly, I did see frame rate drops, but I mean, like, I care. We actually get to have a two-player cooperative experience. So
in the same room.
Yeah, in the same room. So yeah, that's. I'd forgive, you know, the game for, you know, running a little bit more slowly than that. And I haven't unlocked all of the characters yet, because there's several different modes. There's one which is campaign mode, which is actually fairly reasonable. I think overall it is still a little bit short. I did get to a point in the game where everything seemed to be, you know, all happy ending and whatnot. And I was like, this can't be the end of the game. That was a really short game if it was. And then it continued on for a couple more chapters. And it's like, well, it's still a quite short game, but I'll forgive it a little bit. But there is an adventure mode as well, which is kind of a bit like the layout for the original Legend of Zelda on the NES. And you can kind of go to different screens, and there's kind of custom battles there. So you kind of pick a character, or you get assigned a character, and you have different, I think, victory stuff. So, you know, 1 minute it's like defeat this opponent, the other it's like, trials thing where you have to defeat the right opponent based on like certain instructions. Different ones like, basically rack up as many kills as possible, blah, blah, blah. And it's got a leveling up system as well, which is quite nifty.
There is an 8-bit sword and shield.
Yes, there is. There's the amount of fan service in this game. And it's not bad fan service as well, it's good fan services. Stuff like remixed music. You know, so you get a Hyrule theme with a, you know, kind of decent kind of metal guitar type sound from it. Obviously the costumes and characters and whatnot. You get the actual arenas based upon kind of the events of the different games. And
that was fan service in other ways, though. Too much boobage.
There was... was there any particular... Well, Sia. The main bad guy, or bad gal.
And having those extra polygons for that fairy kind of...
Yeah, well, I mean, the fairy... if you remember the fairy from Ocarina of Time, it was like, oh, okay. Fair enough.
Hang on, what?
You know the great fairies from Ocarina of Time?
Yeah,
I remember them.
Basically, they're pretty much the same thing in Hyrule Warriors, only more polygons. So, yeah.
There's more detail.
Mm-hmm.
And certain types of laughter that... all the female characters, except for maybe, like, Zelda and Impa, are, like... the way they kind of have their little, because nobody talks, it's just the weird sort of sound effect type noises they do.
To be fair, Princess Fruto, yeah, arguably naked, but yeah. Obviously there's Fi, or Fi, and, you know,
Midna. I think it was more like sort of like what was going on with like Lana, and then just it was just the kind of like the weird sort of laugh, come breathe, come, what are they doing? It sounds a bit too, I want to say sexualized, the way they were kind of laughing. It was just it was a bit too breathless for its own good.
But yeah, I mean, there wasn't.
Of that kind of fan service.
It's not like it was dead or alive level.
Ah.
You know, jiggle physics and stuff.
And the what was it I heard recently? Bath time DLC.
Oh,
what?
Where they fight in towels, I think.
Really?
I think it's only a matter of time before Dead or Alive is just basically going to become porn.
That isn't fan made. I have to admit,
God, do not Google certain terms.
Yeah. I think the one thing, playing a bit of Hyrule Warriors and watching Paul play it, has the, I want to pick up a Dynasty Warriors game. You know? Because I know it's not going to have all these crazy, colourful characters that I've seen in other games before, but if the mechanics are similar, I'm quite interested now.
I mean, it is quite good. You know, so like having strategy, kind of like you have to think about where you're actually gonna take, and you know, the kind of midpoints and whatnot between them, and when the battles change, and you know, you've got to face a monster or whatnot, and there's different strategies for that. It took me ages to figure out how to beat the final boss, Ganon, or it is actually Ganon rather than Ganondorf, because he turns into a big boar. Spoiler.
To be honest,
God, you spoilt it now.
I think you could see that coming. As soon as, you know, it's an atypical Zelda story, but with far more fighting.
I mean, one of the things that people kind of said is that, you know, oh, it's not true Zelda because, you know, it's basically Dynasty Warriors, you know, reskinned, and it's like, well, have you read the article about, you know, them turn around and saying that they want to do a conventional Zelda title, and Nintendo have just turned around and said, no, you're not going to, you just basically do what you do, but just do it Zelda. And it still works, actually.
I think it's a bit much saying, oh, it's not a Zelda title, because the problem with like Link and all the situations he tends to end up in the games is that they tend to be caught really off guard. No one's ready for dealing with the crap that's about to hit the fan. And so there are no great big armies to help anyone out, because they've all just been caught with their pants down, essentially.
More fan service.
In almost all the Zelda storylines. No, you know, nobody was like prepared to raise a great big army. Whereas okay, so there's a great big army and stuff, but there's a rationale for it. Everyone's been, you know, everyone's got their own forces that they've been using to do various other things. And oh, look, a threat has come, and they're like, oh, we can deploy our forces to go and deal with this threat.
I mean, you can even get cuckoos fighting on your side.
I was going to say, I saw a photo on your Facebook earlier with loads of cuckoos on there, and I was like, hey, what?
Yep, exactly. But anyway, I think it's time to let Emily say what's on her, well, what's been playing on her audio player?
We don't have Audible, you know, sponsorship on this podcast, but I do have an Audible account. Just saying. And
you should get a sponsorship.
I'm on like their cheapest like plan, where you get like pay them a bit each month and you get like one credit to spend on a book to download. And I've been using it to slowly work through listening to, really slowly work through listening to the Game of Thrones books, or Song of Ice and Fire. And I finished, I've got the first four parts, because each book's been split into like two audio parts. I completed the first half of the first book today. And I've just started the second half of the first book. I mean, I know what happens to, in all, well, vaguely what happens in all of it up to, like, Dance of Dragons.
Yeah.
And I think once I get past a certain point, I might just switch over to reading the books for now. But it has been something to listen to whilst on the commute lately, and also whilst doing the, odd bit of knitting. There's been a lot of knitting going on. And I'm hoping to show off next week a particularly themed item I have made. But I can't be at the moment because say what it is, because it's a present for someone. I don't know if they're listening to this.
See, or... I very nearly said. But...
Yeah, or there's a chance. And yeah, so... I can't say any more than that, but it's been interesting listening to it because I can't remember the guy that's reading it, but he does like obviously all the voices and that, but he doesn't get Tyrion quite right. He makes him sound like he's a bit dowdery and and not stupid, but just a bit sort of slow. And it's like, even when I read the books before even the TV series, I always imagined him to be a bit quicker when he spoke, and a bit more sure of himself and his tone. Yeah. And it's kind of painful listening to him do the voices for, like, old women as well. Or just women in general, actually. It's a bit painful. Because it's like, suddenly goes into this high-pitched voice to do, like, Ira or Sansa or something, and it's just like, oh, God. No.
And what, suddenly it's like listening to Monty Python.
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, dear God. It reminds me of, I listened to the audiobooks of the Mass Effect books. So, like the sort of semi-prequels to Mass Effect 3. There are a few characters in there that are, you know, that are in the game that, you know, feature quite heavily in the books. And, yeah, listening to the bloke who's reading them do, you know, female voices. And he suddenly goes a bit like this when it's a woman speaking. And I think, who speaks like that?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, fine. You know, she's not going to sound like a burly brickie, but, you know, it's a little bit weird.
Yeah. Pretty much. And that's what I've been experiencing with listening through to this. But I'm going to move us on to our final bit for tonight, our feature. And I suppose, in a way, it's a bit of a philosophical discussion tonight. I mean, we've already touched on elements of this in the past couple of weeks, but we're kind of evolving the idea a bit now, and we want to... I'm asking, are we, as geeks and nerds, our own worst enemies? And
this yes.
looking at their...
That's all for the evening.
This is... sort of based on the fact that there was a couple of pieces that went up last week. One first on the, I mean, there'll be links to these on the New York Times, which was by Frederick de Boer. He was sort of like wrote when that because geeks have been so used to being the victims and not having a dominant culture, and now they're actually have a dominant culture, but they're still acting like the victims, that all the recent crap that's happened has happened. And then, and I can't remember her name, wrote a response to it for the Washington Post, in which she said, you know, geeks have become their own worst enemies. And, yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, as a whole...
quite true to a small section of geeks, definitely. They do seem to be self-destructive at the best of times.
I'm not convinced that it's necessarily geeks, but culture in general, that is actually a bit toxic.
I think in a lot of ways it is the culture, because wherever you have something where there's a fandom,
yeah,
or people who identify as, yes, this is the thing I enjoy, if someone else comes along and says anything about it...
They just go off the deep end.
Yeah, they just fly right off the handle. And I'm thinking it happens in gaming with, you know, first out, there's, you know, there's fanboys of all stripes.
Yeah.
And when it comes to, oh, let's adapt a book for the TV or as a film, you know, there's always going to be people who are going to react badly to that.
Oh, don't do it. You're going to ruin it, you bastard. You motherfuckers.
Yeah. In exactly that tone of voice. And people who will just complain that, you know, this is wrong, that's wrong, just, oh, and then, you know, fake fans because they only like it because such and such is in it.
I don't understand the concept of fake fans.
The glory hunters.
It's a bit like the, you know, the hipster kind of idea. It's like, oh, you know, the people who were only really Mass Effect fans by the third game. Yeah, they weren't there when it started, man. Oh, piss off.
See, I would consider fake fans something along the lines of people who say that they like something but don't have never actually watched or participated really in what it is that they're meant to be liking. That would be classed as fake fans, but I don't know any.
That also crosses over into the fake geek girl.
Yeah.
Bullshit. Where it's, oh, such and such is only a fan because they, they're only dressing up like such and such because they want attention. It's just the dismissal.
Yeah.
You've got, like you say, the fanboys, you've got it in all sorts of technology now, haven't you?
In Android
versus iOS. Android versus iOS, for example.
I mean, this was one of them posts. This is one of the things that, was it Frederick de Boer was trying to put forward? Was it Frederick or was it the lady whose name I can't remember? I'm sorry, we're going to have to click through on this. But one of the arguments that was being put forward was that because of the way that geeks have tended to set themselves up in antagonistic kind of paradigms, for liking stuff and that somehow that it's always about hating something rather than liking something. Or you like something but you're going to hate something else, or if somebody else likes something that you don't, it's like, oh, you've got to hate it, and oh, one thing's always got to be more superior than the other. And
well, the thing, the problem I have with that being a geek thing is it applies to sport, which is culturally as far away from a geek thing as you can get, even though to my mind as an outsider, because I I am missing the sports gene. I just am. I see it as fairly fucking geeky and cliquey.
Yeah.
The whole sports fan thing. Oh, no. You can't possibly be a fan of such and such because you're only a fan because such and such player has moved there. Or people who will suddenly hate a player because they went from their team to the enemy team.
And I just want to point out the Washington Post writer's name that I've been trying to recall is Alyssa Rosenberg. Alyssa Rosenberg. Okay.
Right. Now we know.
But yeah.
I bet she's a fake journo.
Oh, God.
which is a thing. I saw someone mention it just before. Yeah, this morning. Yeah, where you may have heard. There was a 17-year-old girl who did a restaurant review, and she chose to do a pizza place. No. Because she was starting out, she's just 17, for Christ's sake. So, it was just, write up a place, do a review of a restaurant, and she happened to choose, a pizzeria. And apparently there have been grown people, adults, who, because they're journalists, have been piling bile on her because she actually, did that because it's a pizza place.
Well, some of that is, if you're going to critic food, you still got to critic everything, surely.
Also, she's a teenager. Is she an American teenager?
I think she is.
If Daria's taught me anything, is that pizza is a way of life.
Although, for me, because I'm lactose intolerant, it's a way of pain.
That too.
Although I still love it, so it's kind of a very abusive relationship with me.
She's grown up having a go at her. Are they saying that you shouldn't review, burgers and chips and that sort of thing, or is it just pizza? Are they against pizza?
I think it's just the whole cliquey aspect. And again, you know, these are supposed to be professionals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the whole thing at the moment, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if it's down to technology or whatever, but since we have got so many social networks and ways to reach out and that, we do, there have been certain groups that seem to have become very, their way is their, you know, the way of the land, and it is going to be done this way, and this is a joke done that way, and all this. And all of the sort of understanding that I used, you know, all the understanding and the, oh yeah, actually, that's all right. Yeah, we can dictate to that opinion because you're entitled to your opinion. That all seems to have been thrown out the window now.
Hmm.
Their opinion or nobody's opinion, or we're going to burn you.
I think
it's just depressing a little bit.
Yeah, it is. And I think the main problem is because online is so immediate and you can find like-minded people so very quickly. Instead of it being... Sorry, I do have something wrong with my throat. instead of it being, oh, yeah, your mate Barry thinks just like you. So, you know, you'll have to wait until you go and see Barry at school or work or, you know, at the club or, you know, wherever. And then you can both, you know, sit there and whine about, the same problems as you see them.
Yeah, you can now just ping something there and then and just whine and moan and just get it out of your system.
Yeah, and it's sort of reinforcing. So I think that's the problem.
This is, personally for me, I will call myself a geek from time to time, then a nerd, I'm not bothered by it. And one of the reasons I play games is because it's a release for me. If I've got frustrated during the day at work, or if I'm just annoyed with how life in general is going and it's bumming me out, I will play a game to escape that and release my tension and my hostility so I don't take it out on other people, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I don't blow up like a can of...
It makes perfect sense, because it's the same old release valve, you know, that people have used for probably as, you know, as long as we've had spare time.
I just want to read out this quote from Frederick DeBoer's piece, in which he said, "My fear is not merely that the geeks will never come to acknowledge their triumph, as comfortable as they are in their self-professed victimhood. I fear, too, that we have come to so thoroughly associate fandom with grievance that the two are now inextricable. That, I suspect, is the long-term consequence of the rise of the geeks, that we no longer know how to enjoy art without enjoying it against others. That's a bitter, juvenile way to approach art, and if it's the real legacy of the rise of the geeks, it's an ugly legacy indeed."
I just think he's talking out of his arse.
No, I think he's got a point. I mean, most geeks...
I don't think it's just geeks, though. I don't think it's just geeks. It's just the culture.
It's human nature.
It is human nature. I think it's... The problem is, because of everything that's been happening, is you've got a very select... Well, a group of people who are calling themselves geeks who are making it look that way, where there's other geeks who just aren't getting involved and they're just doing what they normally do.
I mean,
you'll find little cliques like that in any part of society.
Yeah, and what comes to mind is, you know, the old saying of, you know, never talk about, you know, religion or politics.
I disagree with that.
It's the same kind of thing that, you know, if people have, you know, an attachment, then if someone else comes along and, you know, says, actually, I think different, they're going to have a go at them.
Yeah.
That's not a geek thing. Having arguments with people who think differently is not a geek thing. Look at music press. I mean, just look at pretty much anything. Apart from, you know, you're going to have Oxygen fanboys. And they go, no, I've never touched Oxygen, because they're not going to be around for long. I mean, just about everything I can think of that people are going to, you know, enjoy or get interested in, it's going to have a cliquey nature to it. So, it's not a geek thing. It's human nature to be an arsehole if someone else disagrees. And don't you dare disagree.
I think to a certain extent, what he's talking about, though, is the fact that what was once referred to as kind of geek culture has now become more mainstream, and that everything's kind of come with it. I admit that, you know, you're right in that it's kind of a general problem, not just with geeks, but by the same token, I think that there has been an ugly face with, you know, kind of coming out, as it were. How many positive representations of video games have you seen on TV or movies?
Well, that's portraying the whole victim thing again. These obviously individuals were writing from an American angle, and they clearly not had to deal with the BBC's coverage of video games, which even now continues to be one of the most loathsome things that you can have the misfortune of trying to watch on television. Either that or trying to watch the right stuff talk about video games is equally, if not more, painful.
I would just love to know how they managed to find so many people who are utterly clueless about gaming. Considering it's such a big thing now, it's hard not to find people who play games.
It was on the job description on Monster.com. Abilities, not any knowledge on games. This will not help you in any way to report about gaming. We do not want you to have any knowledge. Thank you.
Is it required? Patronising attitude, like a granddad, or, you know, something like that.
You know, it reminds me horribly of what happened with my second dissertation situation, whereby I ended up with a supervisor who hadn't played a video game since the second Mario game, and there I was writing about gender representation and versus kind of storytelling archetypes in video games.
But Pac-Man doesn't have that.
Yeah, that made that really awkward, and I didn't get much help.
It does make me wonder whether it's a generational thing, because, you know, I think mine and Emily's generation was the first to kind of really kind of at least latch onto games in a kind of, even though they're doing other stuff, they still play games type way. Because, I mean, nowadays I don't think there's that much of an excuse for, you know, kind of people older than us to not have played video games, in essence. Does that make sense at all?
Well, back in got confused a bit. Buying cookies, dear, because, you know, we are old bastards.
Oi. I'm just old, I'm not a bastard.
okay, right, I'm old and a bastard. You had to seek it out. It wasn't something, you know, you didn't walk into a room. You know, it would be a surprise to me if I walked into someone's house and they had a computer. Or a games console. But when I was at school, games consoles were not really, you know, a thing. When it came to, the NES came late.
Yeah.
In the UK, and it was very expensive in comparison. We had the original Atari in, like, you know, the early 80s, but again, humongously expensive. So, you know, yeah, it relied on computers. So if I walked into someone's house and they had a ZX Spectrum or, you know, a Commodore 64, or, you know, some poor sods who had an Amstrad CPC, and just waited for a reaction. There we go.
Hang on. You can't prove your point by bringing me into this, you beggar. I love
but, you know, we had to, you know, seek it out. Whereas now, it's such a universal thing.
Yeah.
It's difficult not to. So,
I think you put it better than I did.
In the past 2 weeks, I've been asked to install Candy Crush Saga phones for relatives who otherwise don't really classify themselves as gamers, and the closest they got to regular gaming previously was in older versions of Windows and playing a load of Freesat or Solitaire.
Or like Minefield or something.
Yeah.
Minesweeper.
That was it, Minesweeper. But yeah, and I think that's again part of why there was all that hullabaloo over the articles with, you know, gamer is dead. Where it's what I got from them is it's such a ubiquitous thing that we're surrounded by technology. So in order to, you know, avoid all types of gaming, you kind of have to go out of your way because, you know, one way or another, you've got Tetris, or you've got Bejeweled, or Candy Crush Saga, or even just something like a, you know, crossword. You've got something like that on your electronic device.
That's very true, yeah.
So, you know, that's what I got from it. Mm. And, you know, again, you've got, you know, all these, you know, the BBC journals and, you know, the tabloid journals who seem to have a pride in not knowing anything about games.
Mm.
And I just find that really weird. It's like, I don't watch television. It's very, or the films.
It's very middle, upper middle class of them.
It's a snobbishness, and I just think it's horrible.
I mean, it's not even as much. I could understand, you know, somebody from that older generation not playing video games. That's fair enough. But I think part of the problem that gets me sometimes is that they seem to think of video games as kind of inherently violent and inherently kind of brainwashing in a way.
Or just a complete waste of time with no merit.
Mm.
And then, but then they'll sit down and they'll read, you know, the latest issue of, you know, What's Happening in Soaps.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is...
They get all this imaging from the Daily Mail and other...
To tie this back down to the original sort of subject that are geeks and their own worst enemies, if you consider the ways in which some people pursue their interests, it is extremely obsessive, and it is done in a way which, at least on a personal level, is at the detriment of other activities that not necessarily more useful, but are ones that would help them to survive in life.
But again, that applies to so much. I just think there are so many things that you could say would be incredibly geeky, but because they're a far more commonly accepted thing, they're not seen as geeky. But I see exactly the same kind of behaviour.
But then going back to some of the themes that's also kind of in the articles about how, I mean, previously, certainly like the 70s and 80s, like geeks being portrayed as victims. Most of the time when they encountered any other form of culture or sort of subcultures or groups.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like now it's our media products that are reasonably dominating certainly a lot of Western media, you know, from sort of cinemas to TV to a lot of publishing as well.
Yeah.
To a large degree, yes.
And just kind of like, it's still kind of being portrayed that, oh, our interests are quite niche, or we're trying to portray to ourselves, some of us, that our interests are still quite niche, but actually they're not niche anymore. And then trying to kind of resolve that kind of situation within ourselves, like, oh, but I want to be kind of a bit unique, a bit niche, but my stuff's kind of gone mainstream now.
Well, that thing about Minecraft.
Hipster nerds.
Yeah, hipster nerd.
But what was that thing about Minecraft that you experienced the other day?
Oh god, somebody, I can't name names, but I read a thing by a company who tried to do a tie-in blog post about Minecraft and trying to make it relevant to the area of business they operated in. And
well, I can already say, uh-oh.
It was unfortunately painful to read because they just talked about geeks, saying that was like the main group that played Minecraft. And the majority of Minecraft players I know do not identify as geeks and are under the age of 12.
Yeah. Well, it's also being used a lot in school now, isn't it?
Yeah. But, the kids I'm thinking of, they're all playing it outside of school, but, yeah.
I think one of the things that we've kind of missed out on in terms of, kind of the whole point of these articles, is that basically geeks seem to see themselves in a particular way, and mostly in a kind of mostly male, white, kind of mid-20s kind of way. And so any criticism, So any criticism from people that they think is outside of that group, they automatically turn around and say, "Oh, they're not real geeks. They're not real geeks. They don't have a right to criticize us, even if it's actually legitimate criticism or criticism of culture as a whole." And I think that's part of the problem.
That whole sort of culture of knee jerk is, again, I think that's human nature. It's just we get it. Magnified.
But it's also the fact
and that... And we magnify it in a way as well.
But the thing is that when we say criticism as well, though, we mean like not necessarily saying something is outright the most diabolical thing ever. Mm. It's looking at things with an analytical eye. Absolutely, to the same degree that books and films and even music have have been held up to the past sort of like certainly books like more than 50 years, like since the there's like a term I'm trying to remember stuff from my degree here, and it was an area of theory that I tried to ignore because I found it really boring, and that basically like one university was kind of like in America was tied to sort of introducing a particular type of critical theory when it came to interpreting literature at last century, and that kind of critical thinking is actually a lot what kids end up doing in school nowadays. But once you get to degree level, most of us tend to be like, we're gonna do it a different way now and pursue different avenues of critiquing stuff. But it's the fact that this has been going on with literature for a long time. Film kind of started really having it done to it in sort of like the 60s and 70s. And it was inevitable that video games would eventually be held up in the same kind of eye. So you've kind of got, I suppose in a way, it's a reason why people need to think about whether or not they're writing reviews or if they're writing a critical analysis of something. But then even most reviews now for like novels and films kind of breach these two lines of critique versus review. And it's kind of like, it's this nature of, are you going to talk about just about whether or not you should buy a thing based on these things? But at the same time, do you really want to be kind of like, do you need to mention aspects of it which don't necessarily affect whether or not it's playable or watchable, listenable, but are observations that you have made whilst experiencing the text? And yes, I'm bringing this back round. Basically, I don't think geeks have quite caught on to the fact that the cultural products they're engaged with and that they like can also have the kind of criticism techniques applied to them that traditional novels and films have had in the past 50 plus years.
Well, when we keep on saying like geeks think this, geeks think that,
well, it's really obviously we're a part.
Yeah, it's you know, we're a part of that kind of culture, and yes, it's a bit like certain hashtags that I won't mention because it's when we kind of generalize in that way, it's we're aware that we are generalizing in that way, and we speak as I've completely lost the point now.
Actually, it's a troubled language that we use.
Yes, it's very troubled in the fact that in essence every single thing is just kind of a paradigm. In essence, it's a generalized point that people deviate from in wildly different ways.
And I'm sure when a TV journalist or a lot of journalists will say something about geeks, they don't mean it in the same way we do. Because I am a geek. I know that I am a nerdy asshole when it comes to certain things. I'm just obsessive about stats and things like that, and all the little facts about speeds and machines, how many colors, sprites, raster lines, resolutions, all these kinds of things, what they could and couldn't do. And those are nerdy things. And if someone gets introduced to my I think that's the crux of it. It's my hobby. So if someone criticizes my hobby,
you're going
to
defend
some people are just going to automatically take it as an attack on them. It's a criticism of them.
And they don't see it as a critique for other people, do they? They see it as a bash at them.
Yeah, it's like I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if we're caught in the sort of crossfire of, you know, whether geeks and geek culture and geeky interests are genuinely mainstream or whether they're still small. In some ways, I think they can be both.
Hmm.
An example would be, you know, superhero films.
Yeah.
Now, they're massive at the box office, but I'm willing to bet that quite a few of the people who will watch them have not read the comics, either at all or in years. And actually, I would class myself as that. I have not read Marvel, you know, comics since I was at school, which is quite a while ago now.
There is obviously I always like to read a comic or two.
Yeah. Got to read the comic, God, oh boy.
I think the biggest problem for what we're looking at with where they're bringing up, especially the gaming, is because it has grown to such a massive level, it is going to have more criticism shone on it because it's, you know, there's more people interested in it. And as we're growing bigger and bigger, it does seem like a select few are feeling that their little corner of the world is being taken over and they want to defend it.
Yeah, and I've never quite understood that because I've always been, if you get someone who will play a game, you know, that you like, or, you know, just games in general when they otherwise wouldn't, I have always seen that as a victory.
Yeah. I kind of used to like D&D 3.5, but the more I read of D&D 5th ed, the more I realise that change is good.
You're going to piss off a lot of D&Ders there, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Potentially, well, anyway.
3.5 fanboys.
They are numerous and many, unfortunately.
As are the Nathan Fillion fanboys.
Yes. That's,
I think, you know, we've kind of covered most of, you know, what we want to discuss. But I think, in general, because, you know, we also run, you know, kind of geek websites, so we know how big of a term the word geek can be nowadays.
It's also why the byline of Hex Dimension of overall is, we don't care how big of a geek you are.
In fact, the bigger the better, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean,
as little, it's the fact that it's the just to touch briefly a corner. It's the fact that some geeks will try to set standards for the level of geekiness you have to have achieved in their eyes in order to consider yourself a fan of something, and that kind of gatekeeping is just utterly ridiculous.
Absolutely. I mean, if you know, somebody likes video games, but they've, you know, kind of only played a couple of things on, I don't know, a PlayStation back in the day, you're still welcome to kind of come in and see what we've got to say, and, you know, come into the discussion
and call yourself a fan of video games. I don't expect people who say they like books to have read stuff like, oh god, like Vanity Fair or Robinson Crusoe and Gulliver's Travels or something, you know, like some of the first novels ever to be written, to say that they're a fan of reading.
And likewise, we don't, you know, want to be the kind of people to turn around and say, well, you haven't read those books, therefore anything you have to say about this book is invalid.
All I can say is Gilgamesh or GTFO.
I was talking specifically about novels, and Gilgamesh is not a novel, I think you will find.
And, but also just thinking that, you know, seeing as you know, grew up in the 80s in the UK, you know, my gaming experience was all down to, you know, ZX Spectrums, Commodore 64s, Amstrad CPCs, Acorn Electrons,
BBC Micros.
Yeah, you know, all that kind of thing. Well, you know, BBC Micros if you were a teacher's child.
No, I wasn't a teacher's child, but I still had a bloody BBC Micro.
I'm sorry.
No, I had the first Spider-Man text adventure, and it used to piss me off.
The BBC had quite a few excellent games, and, you know, quite a few of them got converted and, you know, went on to do very well. But, you know, the point is, you know, with us two especially, our gaming experience is home micros of that period. Now, someone who was growing up in the US at the time, far fewer home micros. They basically got Atari and the Nintendo Entertainment System. And, you know, the whole idea of, you know, gatekeeping your hobby. It's like, you know, someone, you know, of my vintage, you know, and Cookie's vintage, you know, in the US would be, well, if you've not played, you know, these games on the NES, then what the hell are you doing, you know, calling yourself a, you know, a fan of old games?
Yeah.
And, well, I'd have to say, well, I didn't have the opportunity to play those. So, yeah, but it doesn't. And, you know, likewise, the fact that they won't have played, you know, most of the games that, you know, we played because, you know, they didn't have access to them. Well, it doesn't, one doesn't invalidate the other.
Mm.
So the entire idea of gatekeeping and saying, oh, someone's not really a fan of, you know, this, that, or the other because they haven't played or watched or read, it's just, it's maddening. Oh. Yeah, and I'm not going to play every game that's coming out now. It's like bloody Call of Duty. I just don't have an interest in it. So, but that doesn't mean I'm not a fan of online gaming.
I think we should wrap this up, but before we do, I think we need to come up with a single statement to summarize. Basically, because we've done you know, a lot of this between, you know, kind of Hex and Nerds, you know, about kind of this type of negative effect on culture.
I don't think we should be against more people being interested in text that we've previously thought were just sort of niche to our general sort of subculture. What we should be worried about is commercial partners taking advantage of this newfound love that people have for geekish things, and that they take this love and decide to produce substandard products that previously they don't hold up to the actual technical quality that should be there in a media product. So I'm sorry, Twilight fans, but those are some really poorly written novels. Some of the films managed to undo the damage of the novels, but generally even the films were poorly constructed.
You're saying some of the films are better?
Some of the films are better than the novels. It's a bit of a mixed bunch. But I'm just saying that basically, if something just because something's popular and people are making stuff about it, we should still hold them up at least to the standard of quality. And quality does not necessarily mean continuity. Quality means, because we're dealing with a lot of fiction here, quality means that it's being created in a way that upholds certain tenets of creativeness and how you write things and direct things and act things.
Okay, that is a long-ass sentence. Can we shorten it, please?
No.
Basically, good stuff is good. It doesn't matter if it's popular or not.
Yeah.
Here's just an idea. Welcome.
That too.
One word.
Get out.
Oh, but I put the mat out and everything.
We welcome everyone apart from the people who we don't.
So I've just dissed Twilight fans.
Yes, and now Twilight fans have a right to diss whatever you like.
They'll probably diss Buffy more than anything else.
Although if they diss the Commodore 64, they'll have me to answer them.
So that is all we've got time for this week. So it's goodbye from...
It's goodnight from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
And it's goodnight from me, Paul, a.k.a. OneArmed_Cookie on Twitter.
And it's goodnight from me, Paul Blur, and I'm on Twitter as @PaulBlur.
And it's goodnight from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter as EK6891. Please don't forget to check out my Tumblr, geekyknittingexperiments.tumblr.com. Because there's some interesting stuff going up on there at the moment still, because I'm still knitting away. And don't forget, you can find Nerd Assemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes and Stitcher. Don't forget, you can contact us at Nerd Podcast on Twitter. Plus, we're on Facebook and Google+ as Nerd Assemble Podcast. Do check out hexdimension.com because there's stuff on there. And I would also like to say that my hot tip for if you want to read X-Files Season 10 is to start with the issue that came out last week, which is Issue 16. I have a spoiler-free review on Hex about this at the moment, but it was damn good.
Good night.
Good night.
And welcome.
Ha ha ha.